Hello and welcome back to Tales from Wisteria Lane, the podcast where we give you a fair view of all things Desperate Housewives. I'm Joel.
I'm Billy Ray.
And today we will be discussing Season 7, Episode 22, and Lots of Security.
Yes, and what a weird title.
Yeah, it is a weird title. So it's the penultimate episode of Season 7, so we're very nearly there at the very last season, which is a weird feeling. Very exciting.
Very strange feeling.
Considering we started this during lockdown.
We started this in a different flat than the one we're in now. Yeah. And we're going to finish it in a different house.
Yeah. But literally, oh God, that's such a weird thing. Anyway, so I will be doing the overview of the episode. And B will be giving us his trivia and chiming in at random points. So what have you got to start us off with?
So, this episode was written by Joe Keenan and directed by David Grossman, and is the 156th episode of Desperate Housewives. So, it's also the 156th episode of Tales from Wisteria Lane, if you don't include our Christmas special, A Kiss Before Christmas. On this week, the number one song in the US was Rolling in the Deep by Adele, and in the UK, it was The Lazy Song by Bruno Mars, so the US really had a speed there.
They really did. I can't stand that song.
On Tuesday the 10th of May 2011, Christina Perri released her debut studio album, Love Strong.
Okay.
Which included the hit single, Jar of Hearts.
Yep.
On Friday the 13th of May 2011, Portugal slipped into a double dip recession after the economy contracts by 0.7% in the first quarter of 2011, with a 0.6% contraction in the last quarter of 2010. But my favourite part of that was double dip recession.
Yeah, I don't know what that means. Double dip recession.
I don't know what that means, but it sounds gross. Also on Friday the 13th of May, Romania officially left the recession after 2 years following economic growth of an annualised 1.6% in the first quarter.
Do you mean Romania?
Yes.
Romania sounds like a name.
Yeah.
Like, hi, I'm Romania.
On Saturday the 14th of May, the 56th Eurovision Song Contest was televised with Elle and Nicki winning for Azerbaijan with the song Running Scared. I will not be watching Eurovision this year.
No, me and B have already made a conscious decision. Like, obviously, it's very easy for us to sit here and say we're going to try and not get political in this podcast. We've been political from the very beginning.
I will not be watching the Eurovision Genocide Contest.
B even emailed the BBC.
Because the BBC's stance is that they are not a political contest. As in, sorry, not they. Eurovision is not a political contest. Which is a joke, because Russia was banned the same year they invaded Ukraine. So, F off of that.
It is a joke. So, if you have the time or what have you, then I would recommend emailing into BBC. They did respond to B. Their response was a load of BS. But if enough people write into them, who knows?
Finally, on Sunday the 15th of May 2011, The Artist, directed by Michael Hazanavicius and starring Jean Dujardin and Berenice Bejo, premiered at the Cannes Film Festival, and it would later win Best Picture of 2012.
Wasn't that a black and white film?
Yeah, it was really good. It was a black and white silent movie.
I've never seen it.
It's really good. I really enjoyed it. So that's what happened on this week.
Nice.
So this episode was viewed by approximately 9.7 million viewers, the lowest ratings for a finale episode the series has ever had, because this episode and the next episode are considered a two-part finale as they aired back-to-back, making it like a big two-hour extravaganza kind of thing, and with a 2.9 in the key demographic, which is 18 to 49. The viewership increased a little for the second hour of the two-part finale, but I'll let you get into that next week. Overall, reaction to this episode from viewers and critics was mixed. Christian Blovelt, a recapper slash reviewer for EW.com, felt that the resolution to Paul's arc was anticlimactic. He wrote, "The Felicia Tillman slash Paul Young showdown comes to an epically anticlimactic ending."
Anticlimactic.
Yeah, sorry, I misread that completely. I find that word a bit difficult.
Yeah.
But he found the ending anticlimactic.
Yeah.
Our thoughts on that, which I don't know yours, but we'll just wait till later.
Let's not spoil it. We can get into that.
The title of this episode comes from lyrics taken from the song The Miller's Song, which is featured in the Stephen Sondheim musical A Little Night Music. And finally, when this episode aired back-to-back with Come On Over for Dinner as the two-hour finale for Season 7, guest star Erin Hayes, who plays Lisa, was credited after Jonathan Scarfe, who plays Andy. However, when the episode was broadcast in Europe, Hayes was billed before Scarfe. The whole sort of who gets billed, when and where, I'm unfamiliar with, but I thought I'd keep that in for title credit buffs if they exist.
I feel like there are probably some out there that do exist. I can't imagine they're the majority. No offense.
They probably heard that truth and they're like, oh.
if they could make sense of it, yeah.
So that's all the trivia that I have.
Yeah. Cool. Okay. So previously on Desperate Housewives, Bree started dating a handsome cop. Tom and Lynette's marriage is worse than ever, so they decided to take a trip together, just the two of them.
Yeah.
Susan admitted poisoning cookies and has now been arrested, and someone new has arrived on the lane. But what do they want with Gabby?
Yes, what do they want with Gabby, this Freddy Krueger silhouette lookalike?
Yeah. So let's do Woody Bree first. So Bree has had Chuck over for dinner and they're having an awkward moment at the door, and he leans in to kiss Bree and then she turns to get the door at the same time, and then they sort of have a bit of a frank chat about intimacy.
Oh, it was vile. So yeah, awkward. It was really cringe. So awkward.
Bree admits that she's very attracted to him and he says the same, but tells Bree that they need to wait until his divorce goes through so that his ex doesn't have any more fuel for the fire, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
Bree agrees and she turns him on with a kiss, like the cock tease that she is, and sends him on his way. And as he leaves, Lee sees Chuck outside and seems to recognize him. So we obviously know that this story is now implying that Chuck is gay.
Yeah, that was curious. But the whole fact that he wants to wait until after the divorce goes through, morally speaking, that's such a huge turn on for Bree. I was like, good for you, girl.
Yeah, I know, right?
But she loves a good tease.
She fucking does love a good tease. And this isn't even the only time this episode where she teases him, knowing full well that, like, he won't do it. He can't do it.
Yeah, this episode for Bree starts with a pretty good mystery, in my opinion, of Lee seeing him and recognizing him, because it most likely means that it's something gay related, because that's all they ever do with Lee.
Exactly. I'm not being homophobic. I'm just clarifying the consistency in the writing.
Yeah. Although it would have been a really good other storyline for Lee of some sort.
Yeah, something that isn't gay related in any way, shape or form.
Like, oh, why does he recognize this detective? How interesting.
Yeah, like, did Bob do some work with this detective previously? Because Bob's a lawyer.
Yeah.
That
could lead into the whole dirty cop stuff.
Exactly. So they really did miss a trick, but they obviously had plans for what they needed to happen with Chuck and why his existence in the story is a thing. So it works out. But Lee is then over at Bree's house having tea, asking about how she knows Chuck, and she tells him that she's seeing him. And then Lee tells her that he's gay because he's seen him at the gay bar, which apparently means that he's gay because, you know, he couldn't be there for anything else.
Well, I did write in my notes that he thinks that Chuck is gay, even though the guy has a wife and two kids and is now dating Bree.
Yeah.
But from context later in the episode, I completely understand why Lee might think that based on how he says that he acts.
Yeah. Bree is adamant, though, that Chuck isn't at first, but the more she says and the more Lee sort of points things out, the more concerned she seems to become.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, and in this scene, Bree says to Lee that he says that about everyone, that they're gay, and then she points out that he said it about Tom.
Yeah.
Scarvo.
A running gag with Lee.
It is. And then Lee says he didn't say that Tom was gay. He said that if he had magical powers, he would make Tom gay.
Yes.
Which is kind of concerning, but that's a different topic.
Yeah, but I understand.
Mm.
I've seen him in the Speedo.
We've all seen him in the Speedo. We don't judge Lee here. Absolutely not.
Sorry, Lee. I'm on your side here. So, not sorry.
So, Bree goes to meet Chuck for lunch, but he has to cancel. And he introduces the precinct to Bree so they can all believe him when he talks about her now, which is just another little red flag.
This was an ew moment for me. This was ew.
Why?
He says, look, I wasn't making her up. No, he says, see, I wasn't making her up. And, like, shows him her off to the I was just like, oh, that's a weird way to introduce her to everyone that you work with.
Well, it's just, it's the point of the red flag, isn't it? Because all of Chuck's colleagues now think, oh, you know, Chuck doesn't have a girlfriend, ha ha ha. Like, and so then that just makes Bree think, oh, why would they think that I'm made up? It's fuel for the fire for Bree. That's the point.
It made me very uncomfortable.
So he goes back to work and leaves Bree looking at his desk, and she sees a picture of him and Pete, his partner, or at least they were partners until something happened and nobody really seems to know what. And then the police officer that she is talking to is like, oh yeah, it was really weird. And that's all he had to say.
Yeah, he says, not tragic, just weird. And I, like, what the fuck, man? Why are you making people feel weird about stuff?
Yeah, I know. And now this fuels even more of Bree's homo suspicions.
Yeah.
So, Bree then meets up with Lee again and gives him all the info. And she shows him the picture of Chuck's partner, Pete, and explained that they were besties and partners for 9 years. They went on a camping trip, came back, and they weren't speaking, and that's when Pete transferred. Lee believes Chuck was clearly in love with him and that he professed his love on the camping trip, expecting it to be all Brokeback Mountain, but that didn't happen. And then Bree decides she's going to prove that Chuck isn't gay, and Lee asks Bree for the picture so we can pull a Kate Middleton and play around with some Photoshop.
I think it's very funny that Lee is manifesting gayness on everyone.
anyone and everyone he can. And Lee even seems to link it to his, like a story of his. I swear, anytime any of the girls say some sort of story, Lee manages to twist the story so he's like, oh yeah, something similar happened to me. Oh my god, it's just like me and this other guy.
But he recounts his story whilst imagining Chuck and his partner, Pete.
Yeah.
And he's just sort of sitting there getting lost in the fantasy and getting like...
turned on.
Yeah, and it's really cringe. I thought this was really cringe. And I was just like, can you guys stop writing Lee?
Just stop writing Lee.
Like, as much as I like some Lee moments, I think I'd rather you just killed him off, because you clearly don't know how to write gay men that aren't Bob. And even then, that's, like, not even the best representation of a gay man.
No, it's
some
really
not. Some self-hating
they're
straight
just,
bro.
Yeah, they're gay characters from back in this era anyway were very stereotypical and really leaned on the whole gayness of them because audiences found it funny and charming and all of this sort of stuff. There is no depth to Lee.
There really isn't.
Zero depth to him, and at no point are we given any depth to him. The most depth we've ever had from Bob and Lee was their fight to have a child.
Yes.
And their consistency in wanting to go for a child.
And even with that story, it was only to facilitate the main housewives stories again.
Yeah.
And sorry, I know that they're side characters, but if you're going to give them a story, make it about them. Gay people aren't just in real life to facilitate straight people doing anything.
Yeah, and I'm
so lazy.
I know there are a lot of Bob and Lee stands out there, but as B said, we're not side characters to your main gigs.
Yeah, like our main life stuff isn't to facilitate what's happening in your lives, and I just want better representation. What can I say?
Yeah.
Especially from a gay writer.
That's the thing. If it wasn't a gay writer, I probably wouldn't be harping on it so much.
By the way, I just want to clarify, I mean a gay show writer.
Yeah.
Mark Cheryl.
Yeah.
Like, Mark Sherry.
If it was sort of a heterosexual, you know, gay showrunner or, you know, show creator or what have you, I probably wouldn't be harping on about this so much. But because he himself is a homosexual man, I would have expected a little bit better, even around the time that the show aired.
Even, I mean, straight women write better gay characters.
Yeah.
Famously.
Yeah. But anyway, we've gone really off tangent.
Yeah, let's tangent back.
Yeah, we'll take a swing back. Bree and Chuck are on their date, but she isn't ready to call it a night yet, which is fine with him because he knows a fabulous little place.
He said the word fabulous and Bree's mind was like, fuck. He's gay.
But Bree wants to go to his place. Chuck says no, as he doesn't think he can trust himself. So Bree gives in and takes him to her little place, which is a gay bar. Chuck tries to explain how he knows about this little gay bar, who I'm pretty sure we saw the outside, so we would have seen the name, but I didn't write it down. But he is interrupted by someone called Clarence, who gives him the dirt on Steve and someone who was formerly Fat Steve and is now Pissed Steve.
Yeah, it sounds like he's depressed and becoming an alcoholic.
Yeah. Bree then tells Chuck that she knows everything and reminds us all of why she is the queen of growth by telling us that she loves the gays.
Yeah, that was an iconic line. My son is gay. I love the gays.
I love the gays. I just don't date them.
Yeah.
And season one Bree would never have said that. Those words would never have come out of season one Bree's mouth.
No.
But it turns out that Chuck isn't gay and he's just working undercover here at one point.
We could have seen it coming from a mile away that he was undercover here.
Yeah.
And apparently he was very good at it.
He was very, very good at it, apparently.
Although I didn't really appreciate that random guy walking by and slapping his ass. But then again, maybe when he was undercover, he would do that to him as well. And he would just get as involved as he could.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So, but it is brought up that he hasn't been seen at this club in a while. Clarence says that when he first walks in. He's like, I haven't seen you for a while. So God knows how long ago it was that Chuck was undercover here.
At least as a straight guy pretending to be a gay guy, he can finally have cocktails without being judged.
Yeah.
It's so frustrating being around straight people that pretend that they would never drink a cocktail. Oh no, I can't drink something sweet.
Oh my God, bitches. Like, just have a fucking cocktail, honestly.
Like, honestly.
Your dick ain't gonna fall off.
You can drink a beer, but you can also have a porn star martini.
Yeah, there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. At least a porn star martini tastes good.
It's just passion fruit. There's something gay about passion fruit.
No. Well, I don't know.
Maybe a little.
It's the gayest of the fruit. Anyway, Bree doesn't believe him and brings up Peter, so Chuck fills her in on that drama, and apparently he considered Pete a brother until he found out that he was sleeping with his wife.
Mm-hmm.
And that's basically where Bree's story ends.
Yeah.
They kind of...
Good for Bree.
They kind of, like, make up, and Bree, they, like, kind of kiss, and Chuck's like, oh, would a gay guy kiss like this? And then they kiss, and then Bree's like, okay, I believe you're straight.
Yeah, yeah, pretty much. So, good for Bree.
Yeah, good for Bree. So, that is Bree's story.
Yeah, let's move on swiftly from that.
Yeah, let's move on to Tom and Lynette's, which is even more depressing and also even funnier.
Yeah.
So Tom and Lynette have gone away for a long weekend to save their marriage, and conversations already weird and uncomfortable between them, and Lynette states that a weekend away without the kids or work or TV is just what they need. And Tom gets butthurt that he won't be able to watch TV until Lynette calls him out.
Yeah, him being shocked by the no TV at the B&B, it reminds me of that Simpsons episode where Homer and Marge take marriage counselling, but then he ends up going fishing.
Yes, that's true. This entire storyline makes me uncomfortable because of the interactions between Tom and Lynette.
Oh, it's very uncomfortable.
It is really uncomfortable.
Just to point out, though, this TV thing does come up again later.
It does come up again later, and so does something else, but we'll get to that as well because I didn't make a note about it. But there's this awkward conversation between them. Like, it's not easy conversation between this husband and wife anymore. It's forced. It feels like neither of them want to talk to each other, really, and they're just kind of saying what they can to kind of end the conversation.
You can tell they've walked in and they're hyper fixated on thinking about what they say first.
Yeah.
It's really sad.
So there was a bit of awkward misunderstanding between them, with Tom saying he's ready for bed and Lynette wanting to get pounded. But they agree to get some sleep because they've got the whole weekend. Again, that's another awkward bit.
Yeah, it is a bit awkward.
So the next morning, Lynette is looking at what they can do as a couple, finding a candle-making place. But Tom would apparently rather shoot himself, which were his words, not mine.
Well, I like candles, but I don't want to make them.
No, me either. But if, you know, I'm trying to spend some time with the wife, I'd do that.
But also, if you end up getting a divorce after this weekend, you don't want to be looking at that candle to remember it by.
No, that's true. They remind themselves of why they're here and are about to head back to their room to talk when a younger couple enter and introduce themselves as Lisa and Andy, and it's the third time that they've been here and they're loving it, apparently.
The third time?
Yeah, they've been here for, this will be their third time here. It's so intimate and peaceful and quiet, or whatever she says.
Oh well, good for them.
Yeah, but anyway, they ask what Tom and Lynette are doing, but they don't know, so Andy invites some candle dipping with them, which they both jump at the chance to do. And I would like to point out that Tom was the one that said that they better have a gun at the candle making place when Lynette suggested it. Now, these two say, do you want to come candle dipping with us? And Tom is the first one to say, I don't know, it sounds kind of fun.
Again, it's very sad. They clearly do not want to be alone together.
Yeah.
But you need to be alone together, otherwise when does the talking start?
It's rather triggering, this whole storyline. I've been there, I've done that. I've felt it, I've witnessed it. Like where it got to a point in my previous relationship where I ended up spending most of my days around my friend's house, or I say days, my evenings around my friend's house, because it got to a point where I just couldn't be around him anymore. It did not make me feel good to be around him anymore, despite the trying, despite the effort. And so I would do all I could on the days where it was me and him to organize something with my friends.
Yeah.
Because I didn't want to be alone with them.
Well, it's a two-way street, and if only one of you is trying to communicate, it's like talking to a wall.
Exactly. So Tom, Lynette, Andy, and Lisa all come back, and it turns out Tom has paid for everything that day. And I'd like to just point out...
I hate this scene.
I'd like to point out to everyone it's nighttime now, so it's been like the whole day.
Yep.
Andy and Lisa clearly just kind of want to get away from this awful couple. They've spent all day with them, and they thank Tom for paying, as he actually said, "What's the point in making the big bucks if you can't spread it around?"
Ugh, I hate it so much.
And do we remember when Lynette called him a pompous ass in the last episode? Like, here we go.
Oh my God. Why? Oh, businessman Tom is so cringe.
It gets even worse because Tom and Lynette just won't let them go.
No.
They're there like, oh, okay, we should head to bed. And Lynette's like, no, we're playing cards. Come on, guys, against the girls.
But at least Andy and Lisa might never come back again. Maybe they'll try some other holiday destinations.
This is true. This might push Andy and Lisa to broaden their horizon.
God, it would certainly push me away.
So we cut to later in the evening, and they're now still playing cards, and Tom Pescavo is telling a story, but Lynette ruins it by chiming in with the punchline. Tom then calls her out, saying that she always does it, but Lynette apparently does it because she gets bored of his stories.
This was hard to watch.
Yeah.
She said his punchline, I was like, oh, Lynette.
Yeah.
But I can tell that she's just getting really wound up by him. Like earlier when he said about making the big bucks, and she was like,
yeah,
I hate when you say that.
yeah. Well, it's an awful thing to say. You don't say that around two people you've just met.
And then, finishing his punchline. Oh, it's so bad. It's so bad.
It's very ironic that Tom will sit there and moan at Lynette for emasculating him constantly. But then Tom has zero problem emasculating this random man he's just met today, because that's what that was doing.
Because it's not okay for women to emasculate men, but it's only okay for men to emasculate men.
That's true.
When they're managers.
So Tom has no problem emasculating this guy by being like, I'll pay. I get the big bucks. Don't know what you're on, but I get the big bucks. I'll pay.
Not gonna lie, if we were that couple, I'd be like, you can emasculate me. Like, you can pay for my dinner. That's fine.
Pay daddy.
And then like, when we get home, I'll be like, wow, we didn't pay for anything this holiday.
Yeah, I know. It's
fucking great. But yeah, the tensions are so high. They are just winding each other up, but it's so underhanded.
Yeah. Oh, God, yeah.
Oof.
So Tom and Lynette end up having a bit of a bickering match, leaving Lisa and Andy feeling uncomfortable, and they run away, and then Lynette heads off too, but Tom decides to stay downstairs for a bit.
Yeah, to watch TV.
Yeah.
To get the scores.
Yeah.
And she's not happy about that.
Maybe he's just really into Orange is the New Black.
Maybe he... But, yeah. What a random thing to say.
I thought you would have got that.
Did get it. I'm just saying, like, do you want to explain? Or are we just leaving that as an inside joke?
I can explain. The last thing I tried to do to save my relationship with my ex was we went on holiday. We went to Paris and we tried, because we were living with his parents at the time. They were lovely, don't get me wrong. Absolutely delightful people. But it just, there wasn't a lot of space there. So we went away for a few days, and that was our attempt to save the relationship, and it didn't work. And I ended up watching the majority of Orange is the New Black on Netflix and our Airbnb in between the times where we would go to the things that I booked for us to do as like a couple. Yeah,
that's so sad.
It feels very much like that.
It's like a sad handwritten book.
I didn't want to watch TV. It's just nothing else was really happening. So
Yeah. Wow, what a triggering story for you, Jesus.
I know. Anyway, it was so obviously Tom that night goes to watch TV, which pisses Lynette off. The next morning is what really pisses me off. And that's when Tom and Lynette are coming downstairs and Lisa and Andy can hear them and they try to run away, but it's too late. They've seen them. And as they're coming downstairs, it's found out, Lynette says, Tom was apparently texting the office on his holiday.
Yeah, and we've already established how much of a problem she has with this.
Yeah.
With him and his office obsession.
He tells Lynette it's apparently not a problem. But Lynette says, yes, Tom, texting the office is the same as calling the office. And yes, it is.
Yeah, it's kind of despicable behavior because she's made it clear that she has a problem with it. And if you are going away together on holiday, especially if you're going alone to essentially sort some stuff out,
mm-hmm.
what are you doing? But it's because she's winding him up.
Yeah.
And vice versa.
They're both winding each other up. But so far, from what we've seen, Lynette is the one that is trying to fix things. And Tom doesn't really seem to be putting in that same amount of effort.
No, not from what we're seeing.
No. So Tom and Lynette intend to spend the day with their new friends again, but they want to go by themselves. Lisa makes an excuse, but Andy shuts her up, respect to him, by the way, and tells them the truth before walking off. And Lisa then wishes them good luck, as she can tell that they're working through things.
Lynette's face, she was like gagged,
shooketh.
They saw that. We were being so subtle.
Yeah, I know. How did they know that we have problems? Did you tell them, Tom?
Why would you tell them that?
So anyway, it's raining now and Tom is losing his mind. But Lynette seems to be sort of just lost. You can hear it in her tone. She's kind of given up.
The weather forecast said it might rain all weekend.
Yeah.
Oof.
She is concerned that strangers can now tell that they're struggling, and Tom snaps at her, so she accuses him of not really trying, and power to her, because I agree. Tom then gets...
Hold on. I do love the line, well, don't snap at me, snap at the rain.
Yeah, right. Because Tom says he's losing his mind cooped up, and so Lynette says, do you want to go for a walk? Which is a little bit ridiculous, because it is raining, but some people like a walk in the rain.
Yeah, but...
And then Tom snaps...
When we were younger, we in a big room raining, we wouldn't just be sitting here talking about the rain.
Yeah.
And I was like, maybe you could do something else.
Tom gets annoyed and grabs a box of an engagement ring, except this time he's changed the diamond. And apparently, way back when he first proposed, he promised to give her a decent ring someday. Lynette thanks him, but tells him that she loved her old ring. And this leaves Tom confused because apparently she always made a joke about the ring whenever she showed it to other people.
I found this scene so upsetting.
It really
because
is.
Because it was like punch to the gut, followed by punch to the gut, followed by punch to the gut. Because when he presented the ring, I was like, oh, he was trying. But then she said that she liked the old ring. I was like, oh, no. But then he said that she made fun of it. And I was like, oh, no.
It's two episodes in a row where we've really seen like this other side of Lynette from way back when, obviously before the show aired, a younger Lynette when they were starting out their relationship. Which kind of brings up red flags.
Yep.
And I'm genuinely surprised that Tom has lasted this long. Like, all the time, all of this show, we've built up and up and up about how Tom's this bad one. He has a new life dream every sodding season and all this sort of stuff. But then you hear little bits like this. Like, last episode when Lynette was emasculating Tom by saying that when you make the big bucks, you can make the big decisions.
And now he won't stop saying it. Like, what I do now.
True. And now in this episode, Lynette was taking the piss out of the ring that Tom was giving her, which is so emasculating because of what the ring represents to a man.
Yeah, and it's really upsetting because she does say she loved the ring, but then he's like, but you were making fun of it. And it's like, that's kind of Lynette's way. And I think it's really upsetting. It's such a communication breakdown.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Anyway, that is Tom and Lynette's story. It kind of ends, again, a second episode where it's kind of ended a little bit ambiguously. Are they going to figure this out?
Well,
aren't they?
I would say less ambiguously this time. This was far more punch to the gut for me.
Yeah, I mean, Tom does end up yelling at her, saying that he's trying to make her happy, but he's running out of ideas.
Well, you can stop talking about how much money you're making.
Yeah.
That's one thing. And then you can stop finishing his punchlines.
But at least he upgraded the ring now, so that if you do get the divorce,
yeah.
just say
like that those rocks were big enough, you can cut through glass.
Yeah. Anyway, let's move on to Gabby. So Gabby is getting the girls ready for bed when Carlos calls on a business trip, but during all of this, someone is watching from outside. Gabby hands the phone to Juanita, and then as she walks past the window, she sees someone out the corner of her eye, but by the time she turns to look, they're walking away.
Why is Juanita eating chocolate before bed?
I don't know.
She's eating like a chocolate bar or something. What the hell?
I don't know. She's a kid.
Before bed?
I read somewhere that the girl that played Juanita ended up getting a bit of an eating disorder when she was like 7.
Oh, really?
Because of like the comments that she was getting. And apparently she had a really hard time with some of the storylines and things with the show, because obviously she's a really young girl and an awful lot of the storylines are basically set on Juanita's weight and looks.
Yeah.
In comparison to Gabby. But she did say that she had a blast filming because Ricardo and Eva were so lovely with her. And in the scenes where they were quite particular about her weight, or her weight was the punchline, after the scenes, they go up to her and they check on her and they give her a hug and tell her that she doesn't need to change and she's beautiful and what have you, which is just really lovely.
It is. I hope you like that, guys, because I don't want to talk about that anymore. Otherwise, I'm going to cry.
Yeah.
I'm going to cry at how sad it is and how nice it is at the same time.
Yeah.
So let's move on. Please. Anyway,
Gabby runs to Breeze, behind Carlos's back, of course, because they're not friends,
yeah,
to ask her for a gun, explaining that she's seen someone skulking around the house, and we have a clip.
Gabby, I'm not giving you a gun.
Why not? I let you borrow things all the time.
Not things that put holes in people.
Come on, just a little one. The kind Nancy Reagan would shoot people with.
No.
Please, I'll be really careful. This guy's kind of freaking me out.
Gabby, if you're really serious, I will set you up with a class at my gun range. They'll teach you about gun safety, you will get a permit, and then we'll see about getting you a gun.
Great. So in the meantime, if skulking guy breaks into my house, I'm just going to yell, Freeze! I'm taking a class!
Freeze! I'm taking a class.
Gabby with a gun is a horrifying thought.
It is, but you know what I really loved was gun safety queen Brie Vanderkamp, of course.
Yeah, I don't think that anyone should be given a weapon of war.
No.
Like, I don't think that anyone's entitled to something that is literally made to kill people.
Yeah, yeah, we're very anti-gun.
But I do appreciate the gun safety sentiment that Brie has here, which is why Queen Brie is the gun lady.
Yeah, she is the gun lady. I love the fact that she keeps them stored in a locker. She doesn't really keep them around the house. I imagine she's got one or two, obviously, because people do in America. But she won't just willy-nilly be like, sure, I'll give you a gun. She's like, you are taking a course. Probably because Brie can see that Gabby holding a firearm is also a recipe for disaster.
Yeah. I am kind of on Gabby's side in the way that you don't have to be so picky, Brie. Like, she lets you borrow things all the time. Come on.
Nothing's a put holes in people.
Such a good line.
The kind that Nancy Reagan would shoot somebody with.
Love that. The girl gun.
Fucking Nancy Reagan. Yeah. So Gabby is at a gun course being a bit of a smart ass. So the teacher calls her out on not taking it seriously. And the guy puts Gabby on the spot asking if she could shoot him. But she kind of flakes in that moment and then uses this as a teaching moment to tell anyone that a gun in the hands of someone afraid to use it is incredibly dangerous.
Yeah, Gabby in serious moments struggles.
She really does struggle.
She always resorts to humor and sarkiness and I guess it just backfired here.
I mean, it's very relatable.
Oh, yeah.
It is very relatable. But yeah, it does.
He did bring her down to earth, though.
He absolutely did bring her down to earth. And credit to him, because that was a fantastic lesson for every other student in that course as well.
I think it's a fantastic lesson for anyone who thinks about getting a gun, especially because so many people think that a gun is their right, you know, the right to bear arms.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think a lot of people go to the gun safety courses, I imagine. And this guy's got a good point. He's like, if you don't think that you can stop someone, you shouldn't have a gun.
Yeah. I think it depends on the state.
Yeah, probably.
State gun laws change with the state that you're in. And some have much, much stricter gun laws than others. It's very confusing how you guys do your laws in America. I can't imagine living there and moving from state to state and having to get my head around new laws.
I just appreciate the fact that if guns are allowed amongst the general populace, we have people like Bree and the safety training course man, who's like, if you're gonna have a gun, take it seriously. Like, this isn't a toy. Like, I'm not just gonna let anyone have a gun so that you can pose like Lara Croft in a picture.
Yeah.
Like, you need to take this seriously. These things kill people.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, it's not just something that you carry around because you have the right to carry it around. Like, it's not really something that you should have. And a lot of people that have guns do end up shooting and before asking questions.
Yeah.
And, you know, really, that's quite a silly thing to do. But we're not here to trumpet gun law.
No, but I do think that a lot of people who bang on about the right to bear arms, they're seeing the ownership of a gun as more of a statement than a practical element.
Yeah.
And I think that's a problem with weapons of war.
Mm-hmm. So Gabby is being a cheeky bitch and eating food from the store that she isn't paying for.
Not Gabby walking around eating cereal.
She's literally eating, is it cereal?
Yeah, she's just eating out of a box of cereal and then putting it to the side. Yeah. Like, oh, I'm done.
Well, she like finishes it, it's empty, so she puts it on the side.
Did she eat a whole box of cereal walking around the shop?
I'm not sure if it was cereal. I think it was just something in a box shaped like cereal.
Maybe.
But I don't think it was cereal. I think it was like crackers or biscuits or something.
Either way, she just puts it to the side. She's done with it.
Yeah.
Like, sneakily as well.
She gets a weird feeling that she's being watched. You know, we've all had that feeling, you know, where you kind of feel like you're being watched and you're not really sure where or what's going on, but it just, the vibe is suddenly off. She gets all jumpy until she does see him.
Yeah, yeah.
She runs after him, but he leaves the store before she can catch up with him, so she asks to see the CCTV footage. And looking at it, she realizes...
Are you sure you want to see the CCTV footage right in front of a store worker when you were just eating a box of stuff and then sneakily putting the box to the side and not paying for it?
Oh, that's...
Are you sure you want to do that?
Doesn't matter. Looking at it, she realizes it's her stepfather, the one that's supposed to be dead.
Why is he acting like a creepy stalker? Like, honestly.
Well, yeah. We'll find out, I guess.
Oh, yeah. That guy's like, your stepfather. You sound surprised. And it's like, well, maybe she is surprised. You don't know her.
He's supposed to be dead.
Yeah, that's nuts.
We then cut to the gun range where Gabby is pumping lead now and ready to kill if she has to.
Yeah, the guy's like, I thought you weren't willing to do it. And she's like, change my mind.
Yeah, so I had to change her heart. So obviously she's preparing herself for something with her stepdaddy.
What a crazy ending.
I know,
especially
right?
For the penultimate episode. What a crazy ending to Bree's story. Gabby's story, sorry.
So, like, I've been so looking forward to this storyline.
Yeah.
I love it so much. It's such a good storyline. But finally, we'll move on to Susan. We'll get hers done. So we actually start the episode in the same way that we started the previous episode, which was a montage of Susan talking about how wonderful and amazing she is, which I'm pretty sure we had in the last episode as well.
Well, Mary Alice talking about how wonderful and amazing she is.
Yeah, it's not Susan talking about herself, but apparently this time she's always played by the rules, except for that time she broke into Edie's house, burnt it down and kept it to herself.
Yeah, yeah.
All that time she was driving the car that killed Dave's wife and child, but Mike pretended to be driving because Susan didn't have a license on her or something.
Yeah, but she always follows the rules.
Always.
For important things, always like follows not the rules. Walking on the grass.
Yeah, or when she didn't have health insurance and so she remarried her ex-husband so that she could get a decent health insurance cover for her wandering spleen. But other than that, really followed the rules.
Yeah, other than those little instances that really are of no importance, and I totally didn't harp on about the house burning forever.
Yeah, I know, right? Here we go. We're going to have to go to have a deep dive and find out when the last episode was that B mentioned it, because it's
she
been a
burnt
while.
Down Edie's house.
Anyway, Susan is in an interrogation room being, well, interrogated by a detective, where she keeps putting her foot in her mouth and kind of implying that she and Felicia were working together. Another instance of Susan being a twat, I would like to point out, because why you're being weird. So it's like Susan in this scene is deliberately being vague.
Oh, yeah.
With
poor Susan is, she's really bad at explaining herself when she's in the hot seat.
Like, Felicia was helping me cook Paul's meals, but behind my back, she was adding poison. Paul confronted me about it, and that's when I realized I ran to the school because I'd given them the cookies. Story explained, girl. There you go.
Yeah, there were plenty of opportune moments for her to just say the problem.
Yeah.
Why couldn't she just say she must have snuck the poison in?
Yeah, but instead, she's always a bumbling idiot.
Yeah, she's always Susan about it.
She's just so Susan about it. But Susan denies it all, but the detective does make a very valid point that Susan would have a motive to poison Paul and to poison the people at the school. One, because Paul made her lose her kidney, and two, the people at the school fired her.
That's very true.
I think they also then find antifreeze behind her house in that scene.
Oh yeah, they find syringes of antifreeze in the bins.
Yeah, which then just further...
And a purse full of vomit for some reason.
My keys.
No keys were found in that purse.
Susan is having a meeting with Bob, her lawyer, and she is adamant that this was all Felicia. Bob tells Susan that it won't be believed unless they have evidence to show Felicia was actively trying to kill Paul. So Mike chimes up to say Felicia asked him to kill Paul for her when she was behind bars.
Yeah, that was a crazy point because that came up earlier in the show and I was like, well, that's just random and pointless, isn't it?
But this is why they did it.
But again, it's still kind of random and pointless because it doesn't play a role in it any further.
No, not really. It just kind of, it kind of just gives them a lead.
Yeah, so still random and pointless, but I was surprised to see it come up again.
But at this, Susan is gagged because she had no idea that this was asked of Mike. And Bob leaves to follow that lead, hoping it will be helpful.
Yeah, you guys should really start talking. I mean, look at Lynette and Tom.
Yeah. Alone in the room, Susan calls out Mike for keeping it from her, but Mike says that he was ashamed because he did consider it because of their financial trouble at that time. Mike does rightfully point out here as well that there was a time where he'd have killed Paul for free and Felicia was only offering him 10 grand. Just 10 grand to kill a person.
Now, I'm pretty sure that as a hitman, you can get a lot more than that.
Exactly. 10 grand? And you know how desperate Felicia is to kill Paul. I'd be charging way more.
And we know how much debt Mike and Susan have been in.
Yeah.
I'd be like, that's barely going to clear my health insurance.
I'd be like, sorry, Felicia, I want at least 90 grand.
Yeah, like, come on. Come on, lady. More than that.
Felicia is at home doing her nails like an icon when she gets a call from the police station asking her to come down to answer some questions, and we then see her start to panic.
Yeah. Who is that?
Hello.
I love that.
Mike goes to Paul to remind him that Susan wouldn't kill him even if she wanted to, and he tells Paul that Felicia was helping with the food, which apparently he still had no idea about.
This guy is so fucking dense at the end of the show. It does my fucking head in.
It's not his fault if nobody told him that Felicia was helping cook the food, something that Susan could have told him before she ran off to the school.
I know, but it's the same as the last episode where I said, read the room, Paul.
Yeah. So Mike then openly admits to Paul that Felicia offered to pay him, and this is the scene where we find out that he was going to be offered 10K. And then they run over to Felicia's place and they see that it's empty. She's packed her things and she's ran.
As you would.
Yeah, absolutely.
She's like, I'm not going back in the slammer. Are you crazy?
She just got out.
Yeah.
And where would her daughter's ashes go while she's locked up?
Oh God, I don't know. Because no one even knows that those ashes are still here.
Exactly. So Susan comes by to see Paul, where he apologizes for doubting her and lets her in. It turns out that he's packing because he is now ready to move on with his life as he doesn't believe he belongs on the lane.
I like that they instantly make up.
Mm.
I do like that she's not holding it against him. They seem to have this understanding now, so she gets how damaged he is and understands why he responded that way.
Yeah.
I like that.
It was nice, yeah. Susan disagrees with Paul, but it doesn't make any difference. His mind is made up. And he gives Susan her keys back and tells her she can now move back in. So Susan can now move back to the lane.
I like that he wants to leave while Susan still thinks he's a good person. It's just quite sweet.
Yeah. Paul takes what is assumed to be a last look out over the lane, because it kind of genuinely feels like it's just his last look over the lane. And he like, but then he also pulls down his garage door and then goes back indoors.
Yeah.
So I'm not really quite sure what that's about. But when he goes back indoors, he's whacked by something as he enters his house.
Mm-hmm. Which was quite a comedic little shot, wasn't it?
It was, yes. He then wakes up tied to a chair, a drip slowly letting antifreeze into his bloodstream, and tape over his mouth. And Felicia warns him that if he screams, she will stab him in the heart with a giant syringe of antifreeze, killing him instantly.
Yeah, but I would rather that than slowly die.
Yeah. And so she removes the tape so that her and Paul can have a little chat, girl to girl.
Yeah, sometimes it's nice to have a little chat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, at the flat, Susan and Mike are packing up and decide to set up MJ's things at the house, ready for him as a surprise. So Susan jumps in the car to go and get them ready.
Yeah, so in other words, the show wants a reason for Susan to be in there.
Yeah.
Very similar to how Gabby went into the Bolan household at the end of the last season. And similar to how Susan found her way into the house when Zach was pointing the gun at her.
Yeah.
They always find a way.
They always do find a way, but I, at least with the Susan and Angie Bolan one, it was kind of more believable because Angie hid a note.
Yeah, that's
true. In
the
lasagna, and Celia ate it and then spat it out.
But yeah, Susan and Mike are talking about their nosy neighbours here and how they're going to miss them, but not really. And I feel for you guys. You know, you got the noisy but very nice neighbour next door, the girl with the elephant feet stomping around upstairs, especially when we're trying to record our podcast and we have to keep pausing.
Yeah.
And then you have the cars and the motorbikes zooming by, honking their horns, which means we have to keep redoing takes of the episode.
The old friend of mine that lives above the neighbour that lives next door to us.
Yeah, it's all a bit much, guys.
It is all a bit much.
But yeah, this is funny timing because we're also like, yeah, same.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. And at the point of recording, this time next week, we will be in our house, like our bought home with a mortgage and shit.
End of terrace.
Yeah, end of terrace, garden, like, oh my God. So back at the house, Paul is giving Felicia dirty looks and she's upset that he isn't really giving her more to work with. And so she tells Paul that she wants him to apologise for the murder of Martha, but he refuses to apologise for killing that horrid woman. And then Felicia grabs the videotape as she now has Paul's confession and appears to be happy that she can at least prove her sanity.
And then he's like, no one's going to believe that you're sane, even with that, honey.
No, I know, exactly. Outside, Susan is walking into the house, but she can hear voices and she peeks in and sees the scene. So Susan secretly calls 911 and then hatches a plan. And she uses one of MJ's toys that makes the siren go off. And she like puts it against the wall and she sets it off. So then Felicia hears what she thinks is a real siren.
Well, from a distance, it might sound like a real siren.
Maybe.
But I do like that Susan has found herself walking into a pretty bad situation, just like season one's penultimate episode. It's a very nice callback considering that this whole season
that
is very throwbacky.
True, because she did that with Zach, didn't she?
Yeah, and I think it really fits what this season seems to be doing by making it very early seasons-esque.
Yeah. So Felicia freaks out hearing the siren and runs from the house, and that frees Susan up so that she can now untie Paul. Outside, Felicia realizes there is no siren and comes back indoors and finds the toy. And so she whacks Susan over the head and tries to stab her with the syringe.
I do find that this was actually a surprisingly smart and capable moment from Susan.
We're not used to seeing Susan succeed so much.
No, she doesn't normally come up with good plans.
No, she really doesn't.
Proud.
Paul grabs Felicia and tries to strangle her, but Susan convinces him to let her go because he's not a killer. And so he lets her go and Felicia runs. And the police turn up after Susan's phone call she obviously made. And Paul does then decide to come clean about Martha and gives his confession to the police.
Is this the redemption arc? Are we finally getting the Paul Young redemption arc?
It feels like it's come around full circle. It's only taken him about 11 years, but he's kind of realised that, you know, he needs to be honest about the fact that he's killed Martha. He can't keep running from this anymore.
It feels like the end of the show because it's so full circle. However, to be fair, I think he should have a reduced sentence for this, considering not just the reason he did it, but like, you know, just a little bit of a passionate crime there.
Crime and passion.
But also, he has been to prison already for a while for something he didn't do, which was also for murder. So I kind of feel like you should take that off of this sentence.
No, absolutely not. I know
you can't send someone to prison for the same amount of time for another murder when you've already sent him to prison for a murder he didn't commit.
Yeah,
I don't think that's fair.
Yeah, but that's not the fault of the government.
It kind of is, yes. If I were the judge, I'd be like, well, we did send you to prison for murder already and you didn't actually do that, so we'll take those years off of this one.
Absolutely not, because when he went to prison that first time, he was not taking accountability. And that's the thing. That's the key word in this moment right now, accountability.
But he didn't do it.
but he's not taking it. He wasn't taking accountability for his murder of Martha way back when he was in prison that first time. He now needs to take accountability for what he's done here. He also needs to take accountability for that dumbass plan he had, ruining the lane.
Yeah, that was a bit much, wasn't it?
Yeah. So we now move to the ending of the episode, and Mary Alice talks about security, because that's what the name of the episode is, and we see Bree and Chuck kiss again, because we haven't seen that enough, Gabby keeping a gun on her at all times, Paul being taken away by police, and finally we see Felicia driving away in what is probably the most hilarious death scene I've ever witnessed on television before in my life. And she is driving along the highway or whatever road that she's on, and she tries to look at the map and knocks over her daughter's ashes in the car, which then starts rising up because of the aircon, and she chokes on them, can't see anything, and drives headfirst into a lorry.
Yes. Now, well, that was a choice, wasn't it? That was in the writer's room. What the fuck were they thinking?
What were they smoking? That's such a weird death scene. Like, how you rise up to, for Felicia, she'll go down to hell, and they'll be like, and how did you end up here? Choked on my daughter.
Choked on my daughter, got hit by a lorry. I mean, this is a great cautionary tale for road safety. If you want to look at your map, you pull over safely before you do anything like that, and then you won't get hit by a lorry.
It's also a reminder of how easy we've got it now that we've got like Google Maps and sat nav and shit.
Yeah, because I can't read a map.
No.
What, are you crazy? Looking at all those little lines, I'd be like, I have no idea where I'm going.
Yeah.
But I think this might be why Mr. Reviewer in my notes found this to be an anticlimactic ending.
Because Felicia didn't get her comeuppance. Yeah, she died, but it was a horrific accident that killed her. Felicia didn't get her comeuppance whatsoever.
However, I do like the poetic justice of Beth choking her before she died.
Beth being the one that killed her. I do appreciate that.
In a symbolic, poetic way, I did kind of love it.
Yeah.
Like, Beth getting that last little bit of revenge on her shitty mum.
In, like, a camp way, I did kind of love it. It gave B-movie. It gave very B-movie.
Oh, yeah. Camp way. Perfect. Perfect ending in a camp way.
It's not the tea. Like, I'm sorry, that's not the... I would not be happy. If I was on a show and they gave me that death scene, I'd give back the script and be like, I'm really sorry you're rewriting this. I'm not dying this way.
Why didn't she just get knocked out when she was thrown against the wall so that she could get arrested?
Yeah.
I don't get it, but... Yeah.
Because arrest also doesn't feel like a very satisfying ending for Felicia.
Well, they're not going to go hardcore and have him plunge the syringe into her eye.
I mean, I know it's not like, Hostel or Saw or, you know, something gory and horrible like that. But a death is really, the only satisfying ending I can see for Felicia is a death. And they just needed to do it the right way. But that was not the right way.
I mean, we can't all go out like Patrick Logan, because that was a hell of a way to go out, and I guess they just couldn't top it.
That is the way I would want to go out, though.
If I was a villain.
Looking at the person and being like, you bitch, and then exploding.
Yeah.
But like a fabulous firework.
But even that's too camp for Felicia. That's reserved for John Barrowman only.
Only John Barrowman. I wouldn't be surprised if he had a hand in his death scene.
He was like, that wasn't even scripted, him going, you bitch.
No, absolutely not.
So yeah, mixed feelings on Felicia's ending, really. Mixed feelings. Yeah. Camp, fun, poetic.
But a bit lackluster and unsatisfactory.
Yeah, in terms of actual like writing and the consequences, but in a poetic way, it's great.
Yeah. And that's the episode. There we go.
So, yeah, let's move on to our next segment then, where Joel's going to give us the gayest and the straightest moments. So what do you have for the gayest moment of the episode?
My award for gayest moment... I'm giving it to Lee again.
Oh, yeah?
He's getting it a lot recently, but he is very gay. because we all wish Tom Scarvo was gay, right?
Oh, yeah.
That and the taking of the Photoshop. Well, the taking of the picture, because he's got worked on Photoshop.
Oh, yeah. That kind of reminded me of those little Photoshops you found for those stories.
Oh, God. Those, like, queer Desperate Housewives fan fiction stories.
That's totally what he's going to do.
Yeah, absolutely. I wouldn't be surprised if he's the author. Like, he's just... Yeah, his use of Photoshop is given real Kate Middleton, and that's also gay energy.
And then what do you have for straightest moment?
My award for straightest moment... I'm giving it to the security guard at the store that thought that Gabby's handbag was her pocketbook.
No, this is my pocketbook.
No, this is my purse.
Oh, that's it.
Men.
Yeah. Maybe. Yeah, I mean, that was a very gay energy from Gabby. But I completely get that. Very straight man, that.
It is. Who knows what the difference between a pocketbook and a purse is?
I don't know. Isn't it a book? What's a pocketbook?
My point. So there we go, guys. That's my award for gayest and straightest moment. So bravo, Lee, and unnamed security guard at unnamed shop. And I move on to B's awards for best and worst parents. So who do you have for the best parent?
My award for...
best parent of the episode.
This award goes to Felicia Tillman for bringing Beth with her to have her talk with Paul.
Okay.
Well, it's nice to involve your kids, especially when you're doing things as part of a revenge for them as well.
I still don't believe for a second that was revenge for Beth.
Well, there was nothing else. There was no one else to give it to.
There wasn't really much else parenting-wise, was there?
Good job, Felicia.
Hey, you could have given it to Susan for wanting to set up MJ's toys ready for it when he gets there.
I will say, though,
the flat.
You really should have put her seatbelt on in the car and then you wouldn't have died.
That is true. That is true. So safety first and all. But anyway, okay, so who do you have for the worst parent?
My award for...
worst parent of the episode.
I don't think I've ever had a thread of awards like this, but I gave it to Gabby.
Well, okay.
Again, for letting Juanita eat chocolate/candy bars before bed.
God.
I don't think giving your kids sugar before bed is a great idea.
It's not. You can really tell that B was grasping at straws with the lack of parenting in this episode, weren't you?
I really was, but as soon as I saw it, I was like, I'm clocking that.
Yep.
And nothing else really came up. So.
Okay.
I'm so sorry. I'm pretty sure that's 3 or 4 worst parents in a row for Gabby, isn't it?
Yeah.
Jeez.
Yeah, but just like it's 3 or 4 the best gay, I think, for Lee. So, or gayest moment, not best gay. We must not go crazy. Best gay.
Oh, yeah. Let's not go there. So... that was Season 7, Episode 22, and lots of security. If anyone has any questions, queries, comments, and theories, where can they find us?
You can find us on Instagram at Boyfriends Review, and you can find us on TikTok at Boyfriends Review, and you can find us on Reddit at Boyfriends Review Pod.
We also have email, which is boyfriendsreview@outlook.com. And also our artwork is done by our friend Louis, who you can find on Instagram at DocRedMonkDesign. And there's a link to his Etsy page where he does commissions.
Yep.
Join us next time when we'll be back in your ear holes with Season 7, Episode 23, Come On Over For Dinner.
Yep.
The season finale.
It is the season, like the actual official final 45 minutes of the season.
Yeah, so... see you then, guys.
See you then, guys.
Bye.